Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about actress and activist Jane Fonda, who, you know, I kind of discovered in the 80s with the Jane Fonda workout book, but I'm sure we'll get to that very important milestone in her career. But Mike, why don't you start us off by talking about, you know, the early days of Jane Fonda?
Okay, and there are many milestones in her career. She's what I call a zeitgeist gal, and by that I mean, and I mean it very respectfully, that her life and her career so closely dovetail with what's going on, not just in American film history, but just in larger American cultural history. So it's not at all unusual that somebody might have discovered her initially through the workout videos, right? I mean, we all have places, where do we tap into Jane Fonda? But let me pick up on your question there. And then actually go back to her origins. I mean, you know, as a reminder that she's Hollywood royalty. Her father, Henry Fonda, of course, was already an iconic actor at the point where you know, she's coming on the scene, and they had a very contentious relationship for much of their lives. We can talk about that. And, of course, her brother Peter also would become a known actor slash director. But let's get directly to your point there in terms of her origins. She's born in 1937, and she has a really kind of privileged upbringing in the sense of, you know, again, her father is, you know, one of the kings of Hollywood that way, and you know, the whole family actually is very well connected. Her mother as well, socially, was very well connected. And you see that reflected in her early life. I mean, she goes to Vassar. And so this is at a time when, you know, women of a certain economic status and social status, you know, she is going to college, going to a good school and so on. And here's where it gets kind of interesting, as in you see her career developing on multiple fronts, or for us, multiple considerations, okay? She first becomes known as a face, if you will, as a figure, if you will, when she becomes a model in New York and is actually on the cover of Vogue. So because she had that beauty going for her, you know, we talk about her in terms of beauty and brains and, you know, the whole package, but it really was her physical appearance that oftentimes would shape, you know, certainly some of the early film career and so on, for better or for worse, if you will. And the fact that then in the late 50s, she's got that modeling career, but she's also on a very serious, not that you can't be serious about modeling, but on a serious level in terms of acting. She actually studies with Lee Strasberg at the Actors Studio in the very late 50s. So in terms of method acting, again, in terms of zeitgeist, she's in the right place at the right time. She's picking up on all that. The year I would highlight, though, is 1960. In that year, she makes both her Hollywood debut with a film called Tall Story and her Broadway debut. And it's worth bearing in mind that she, and for that matter her father too, really have a lot of stage experience. They, you know, we know them for their movie roles, but very quickly on a very local and Baltimore proud note, the fact that when her father married Margaret Sullivan in the early 30s, he was appearing as an actor at the Maryland Theater just off of Howard Street, and they got married in Baltimore, so a local connection that way. And her father periodically, even late in his career, would occasionally return and do stage work. And Fonda herself, you know, had those stage credits, and then in more recent years occasionally would return to the stage. So just, again, those multiple prongs, if you will, of a career in terms of modeling and theater acting and film acting and so on. And that kind of gets us into the early 60s with her and films like Chapman Report in 62. And if you look at some of those film roles, they're, I don't want to say cutting edge in terms of like really, really bold or venturesome, but at that end of the spectrum, you know, as society is changing, taking on roles that do sort of call into question, well, what's the role for women and subject matter? It's a little more provocative than sort of staid 50s norm. So, Marie, why don't you pick up at this point as we really get into her career in the 60s?
Well, I was interested in some of her early days. I read something about her and her dad, a whole book about just about her and her dad. And, of course, her dad is the famous Henry Fonda, who she said was just an incredible actor, but not necessarily a really good father. And she had a tough road to hoe in terms of him being emotionally unavailable and all that kind of thing. But also her mother apparently suffered from mental illness and killed herself.
Yeah, let's pause on that for a moment. Her mother, Frances, was extremely well-known in social circles. I mean, she was somebody who was well-placed in society. She had, you know, I don't want to indulge in armchair psychoanalysis, you know, the kind of reductive question, what was wrong, what was the problem? But her mother was troubled and actually was institutionalized in the late 40s, and then the mother, sad to say, her mother killed herself in 1950. So it's a really kind of, you know, in some ways a privileged upbringing, but also a very sad one, as in, you know, the rich people suffer too, right? And, you know, I shouldn't joke about that, but the fact that, you know, she had the mother who had killed herself when Jane at that point would have been, let's see, Jane would have been about 12 or 13 when her mother killed herself. And then in terms of her father, Henry, ironically, and it's not surprising when you read Hollywood biographies, but ironically, he had this image with the public of being, you know, such an idealistic character and on the side of right and justice and just a really good guy you can trust, sort of like almost, not quite in the Jimmy Stewart category, but sort of in that vicinity of, you know, just somebody with integrity as an actor and with the roles he chose. But by all accounts, he could be rather cold and distant as a father, and they, even by the usual standards of the parents and children not getting along and rebelling, and, you know, even prior to the 60s, you know, generation gaps, they were really distant. And I want to give one very quick sentence from a book. And Jane Fonda, among her many talents, all those prongs of talent, has written quite a few books. In 2005, she published a book called My Life So Far. And here's very quickly something she wrote about her father. Quote, "I realized that if I wanted his attention, disapproval was the best I could hope for." And, you know, that's so sad in some ways, but just simply that they really, I mean, later in life they finally reconciled, and we'll get to that, but for so many years, was she rebelling against him? Well, you can read that in zeitgeist terms, you know, generation gap and certainly into the 60s, and some of the stuff she was doing was much further out than he as a Hollywood liberal would go. You know, we'll talk about that, but also just simply that on some very basic level, I mean, she was not an orphan per se, but that, you know, her mother had committed suicide and her father essentially wasn't there. He was off making movies, and even when he was there, he wasn't there.
What is interesting is how once you're in that world, it's like you know everybody, because even before he became famous, he actually went on a blind date with Henry Fonda, that is, with Betty Davis.
I'd love to be in the fly in the wall. You know what I mean? Like, I can't imagine almost like what they talked about or what. I don't know. That's something that's quite fascinating, isn't it? And it's true, though. I mean, all jesting aside on that, the Hollywood film industry, certainly in that era, on the one hand, it was a large industry. On the other hand, it was a small town. And everybody knew everybody, and there was a lot of dating, if you will. And sometimes it was studio-arranged dates. You know, they'd line up one star with another, and that's a whole other topic. We could fill a half hour with that one. But also just on their own.
This is before they were famous. This is, you know, in the Midwest. This was just somebody in town that he
oh
had.
Yeah, no, you're right. And
so,
in fact, you're absolutely right about that.
Didn't have to be Betty Davis, and then later, you know, they would meet each other in Hollywood. I mean, what are the odds?
No, you're absolutely right about what are the odds kind of consideration of, you know, people who had known each other or dated, you know, back as non-famous people and then meeting later. But again, jumping ahead there in terms of Hollywood, it's interesting. It's kind of roulette almost of, you know, of all the dating and the snap. But the essential through line or thread here, I think, is just simply that he becomes a famous actor and certainly knows and dates a lot of people, but there's, in terms of emotional intimacy, it seems like, you know, certainly with his own son and daughter, something's missing. There's a connection that's not made there. And I think part of it, and I will do some more armchair psychoanalysis, is when you're an actor building a career, how time-consuming and how emotionally all-involving that is, sad to say, it's some of the people who should be closest to you who get cut off, that, you know, you return home late at night from shooting a film, or even when you're home, you're looking at a script, and the kids have got nurses and nannies and maids and private schools and, you know, the whole shebang that way. And you can easily ignore your own children.
One of the things that she said about her dad was that he was very critical about her weight, everybody's weight, but especially pointing out to her all the time that he thought she was fat, which I think is important to mention because she became so obsessed with her appearance and, of course, you know, went through eating disorders, and like you said, she was a fashion model, and then you know, later became famous for fitness and that famous book, which apparently is the best-selling nonfiction book of all time. I don't think it's even been unseated by anything contemporary. And she also said that she had the pressure to be, you know, the best girl in the world, you know, beyond reproach. And I think that's also very difficult because, you know, having to be Henry Fonda's daughter is a full-time job in itself, in and of itself, it sounds like.
Yeah, to double back on something you've mentioned a few times already, in terms of when you became aware of her, the book you just mentioned, the Jane Fonda's workout book, was published in 1981. And then, of course, there was a record and a video and all that. And it was such a national phenomenon. I mean, she's already a superstar at that point. But again, in terms of multi-pronged talent, that she, puts that out. And you're absolutely right. I mean, the numbers are astronomical, actually, in terms of how many people bought that book or bought the videos, whatever. And even people who maybe were not tracking her film career as closely as they once had, or that they could be, they knew her for that. And also, though, it ties together the career in terms of when you're a Hollywood actor, and particularly a Hollywood actress, that obsession with body image, with, I mean, strictly speaking, weight, but just general appearance and so on. Look at how many actresses, Judy Garland, one of the most tragic cases of where the studio, would control or like to control, how much you weigh, what you eat, the pills you're on, this and that. And, Fonda always was, in the public eye that way as to, she was a fashion model. She was a very, really gorgeous actress, which had its pluses and minuses with some of her work in the 60s, but that, later in life, even if she takes charge, if we can put it that way, she's going to be healthy, she's going to exercise, she's going to control her destiny that way, still that obsession with appearance. And to jump ahead very quickly now that she's the other side of 80, she looks great. Whatever combination of genes and exercise and I'll say plastic surgery even, whatever combination of things, when you look at recent footage of her and still photos, my God, we all should look like that when we get into our 80s. And I'm trying to put it in a way that's like joking and not joking, as in she's had that total obsession, as I think an actor, whether should or not, but an actor has to have in some ways, what's the image you project to your public? And we're talking here about, a Hollywood movie star type actor. And, this is, again, I keep using that word zeitgeist, but just in terms of, what society expects from you as a woman in terms of the image you project, the roles you take on screen, and her father. Obsession is, speaking of which, with her weight and so on. That's not at all surprising, that he would kind of want to micromanage something like that. And goodness knows that could have something to do with their unhappy relationship when your father is so hypercritical. And all teenagers are going to be hypercritical of themselves, right, in terms of weight and image and this. But imagine if you also have your father, one of the most famous actors in Hollywood, telling you that, what to eat or not eat, or that you put on too many pounds or something. I mean, that really is not, I'll put it this way, it's not healthy for a father-daughter relationship.
No, it is not. When that book came out, I actually bought it back in the day. And, she really is a very witty writer, very revealing in her story. She talks about all the things that she tried to do to keep her weight down. And at one point, a friend and, gave her something to a pill or something. And they thought it might be a tapeworm, but they decided that living with a tapeworm would be worth it if they could just lose some weight. And I remember when I read that thinking, wow, that's dedication. When you flat out know this, I'm going to swallow a tapeworm so I can lose some
Can you
weight.
Imagine you wake up in the morning and you're combing your hair and you're getting yourself set for the day and so on. And as you look in the mirror, you think, well, I've got my tapeworm in me.
Yes. Let's go eat breakfast.
What a weird thought. Like that should be like almost comforting, right? Well, I can eat what I want for lunch. I don't have to eat a salad. I can eat anything I want for lunch because my tapeworm will take care of it.
Tapeworm. It's the answer to everything. Funny.
Well, at least they didn't rely on the 18th century formula of bleeding her, right? Didn't put any leeches on her, so far as I know.
Well,
but, the thing
if
is,
they did, she left that out.
But let's double back on this point. We're talking a lot about, body image specifically for Hollywood actresses, and again, how through the years, the extent to which Hollywood would and her father might impose certain assumptions or notions on her, but then, of course, the extent to which she, taking charge, express that, whether through the workout video or what have you. But I want to put it in terms of what I call like a plus-minus formulation, things that work for you and against you. I mean, she was a really, well, she's always been a really beautiful actress. I mean, by almost any standard yardstick of, who's beautiful. I mean, she had great looks, let's put it that way. It didn't hurt in terms of becoming a movie star. But with the plus-minus of it, her most iconic role of the mid to late 60s, and iconic's not always a good thing here, but what she was known for. Think about 1965, she marries the French director Roger Vadim. And he is among those, like, husband slash manager slash Svengali, however you want to put it. And, I tend to put it in negative terms there. But, he's shaping her destiny. From what I've read of contemporaneous accounts, she seems, more than willing, if you will. I don't want to make it seem like she's somehow in bondage here and being manipulated. But just, again, where we are as a society in terms of the kinds of roles women were getting or that were thought appropriate. And I'll cut to the chase on this, that, of all all the movies she did in that time frame, which include Cat Ballou, Barefoot in the Park. I mean, it's a range of films. But what do we think of her in terms of, you know, the phases of Jane Fonda's life, the periods? Well, of course, it's Barbarella from 1968, right? Now, when you watch her in that film, is she a champion of feminism there, as in here's an assertive protagonist? And yes, she's beautiful, but it's sort of in like what we'd call a superhero way now of, you know, have that woman take charge, and maybe she even has, if not supernatural powers, at least cuts a great image. In Barbarella, that it's, you know, obviously science fiction, but the way in which her character is literally packaged, I mean, those form-fitting outfits, which, you know, thank goodness she had her weight under control at that point, the form-fitting outfits and so on. Let me ask Marie for her take on this, because you watch a film like that and you say, well, is this progressive or regressive or some odd combination of the two that maybe does speak actually to how conflicted we were as a society then and perhaps even arguably still today?
I think she did that film because Roger Vadim wanted her to. And I think it's not a very good movie, so there's really not a lot to talk about in terms of the quality of the film. In terms of whether it's a, you know, some sort of feminist take on things, I don't necessarily think so. She does look great, though. And, you know, I think you have to have at least one movie like that in your career just because, you know, otherwise, eventually you're going to have to make the one that people say, well, look at you with the big hair and the tight clothes. Everybody's got to apparently make
yeah, but see, the essential, but the, I understand
the hair.
I understand about the hair.
She said that.
It's notable there, but the essential point here is that from a public perspective, we're talking about the image she projected or cut. You know, Vadim obviously did, you know, package her in that as a vehicle. He's controlling her career in that sense, and the extent to which she's malleable and goes along with it is debatable. But in any event, cutting to the chase on that, that is not just the image that was projected, but if you were to ask the public, like decade by decade, what's your image of Jane Fonda? For sure, in the mid-60s, she's been making movies, become a star. What's the film people will mention? Barbarella, you're right. As a film, it's mediocre, to put it politely. It's not a good film at all. But that's not the thematic point that is worth scoring here. The thematic point is that was the image that was projected of her. You know, if you go from that to, you know, a later decade, this and that, and it comes down to whether it's a workout video for the 80s or a movie role for another decade, you know, it sort of gets reduced that way to the image she had decade by decade. And what I was talking about primarily in terms of plus minuses, it's not exactly the most endorsing statement one could find for feminism. One could say that it's exploitation more than anything, that he's packaging his wife that way and you know, showcasing her that way, and she's looked at primarily in terms of physical attributes and so on. You can make a strong negative case vis-a-vis Barbarella, and that it's so bad in some ways as a film, not just mediocre, but so bad that it has camp value, that people watch it to make fun of it. The reason I keep underscoring that is that was the public image. That's what she had to work against in the several years just after that, that she wasn't just Barbarella. It's significant that she would divorce Vadim and try to put that behind her, and she was really bothered, and rightly so, in later years, and people would still keep bringing up Barbarella. And for sure, if you read an article about her in a newspaper or magazine and it had three or four photographs, like stills from her movies, if they had a selection of three or four photographs, Barbarella would be one, right? You know, and I can imagine, you know, she'd probably grinding her teeth at that point. She's made other and much better movies. So that's actually going to take us more like into the late 60s and into the 70s. So why don't you pick up here?
Well, I wanted to mention that she talked about her big hair and how people gave her all kinds of grief about it, that her hair should have its own agent. They thought, you know, it looks like you're hiding something in there. You know, what are you hiding in that big bouffant? But when you get to 1971, just a couple of years after Barbarella, she makes Clute, and she makes reference to the fact that everybody refers to the Clute hairstyle, which was a shag. And I believe I had this hairdo myself at one point. Clute, it goes completely against, you know, what was put out there in terms of Barbarella, although she still sort of marginalized as a character, but she plays a hooker, for which she won the Academy Award for Best Actress.
A very quick preface for that, though. I mean, she had very successfully taken control of her image by the late 60s to work against Barbarella. Barbarella was 1968, which is quite impressive, and I really give Fonda immense credit here in terms of not wanting to be tagged forever as Barbarella and working against it. In 1969, the very next year, she received an Academy Award nomination for They Shoot Horses, Don't They? And then just a couple years after that, you're absolutely right, she received the Academy Award for Clute. And the fact that, you know, she would play a prostitute and a very raw, kind of unvarnished performance in a lot of ways, and it takes me back to, you know, her early method training as an actor, showing her acting chops there. And it's not a function of a performance built just on the physical beauty. It's the acting talent there that comes through. And a very quick addendum there, that this was the very time when Hollywood itself is becoming more mature, not just for roles for actresses, but in general. The fact that a movie like Clute would be made in the early 70s, that golden age in some ways, early to mid-70s, when there's some really mature, really venturesome, really bold, you know, cutting-edge films being made within the Hollywood system. And she not only benefits from that, she's a large part of, or certainly a part of, why we have that. When you look at major actors and directors who really may have come on the scene a little earlier, but they really broke through in that very time period. And then she's on a roll at that point. I mean, she'll get an Oscar nomination for Julia in 1977. In 1978, she'll win an Academy Award for Coming Home, all films we could talk about. 1979, another Academy Award nomination for China Syndrome. A number of films there. You know, some of them are deliberately cutting edge. Others are just good mainstream entertainment. But she's on a roll. I mean, she really has put Barbarella behind her. The media won't always let her do that. They're always reminding her, reminding us of that earlier image. But she's moved into that next phase, as has American society, I would like to say.
So for anybody listening who isn't familiar with her career, if you were going to tell people to watch one Jane Fonda movie, which one would you choose, Mike?
From the entire career, just
from
one?
The entire career, yes. Your top one.
I might well do Coming Home. And I use it in a course I teach on Hollywood in the 1970s, so, you know, I'm partisan that way. I actually have very mixed feelings about it as a film, which would take too long to get into in terms of what I like and what I don't like so much about Coming Home, but it gets back to my overused word, zeitgeist, you know, spirit of the time, spirit of the age, that good German word, and how in Coming Home, it's very much about what happens after Vietnam, you know, after the soldiers come home and how they're received or not received, and of course, within a marriage, how that plays out. And for me, watching it, you know, very much a fictional film, but it's so directly playing off of, you know, a war that had ended just a few years previously, and that really, really, scene by scene, it speaks to what America is like in that period. So there's certainly several other films of hers that could just as readily fill that slot. But if I had to take it down to one, and you haven't given me any choice here, you know, that's the one that does it. And also for Fonda, it means that she is, you know, going to assert herself. And in that film, she does not play glamorous. Her character is just a good, wholesome person, if you will. It's kind of reductive to put it that way, but she's not, you know, coming across as anyone who's meant to be glamorous or somehow special profession or this or that. Just a good, normal person, if you will, and how well she plays that role. And what I'd want to emphasize here is when you see her in that film, you know she has a lot of baggage she brings with her. Think about it. She had been tagged, you know, as Hanoi Jane in 1974 when she co-directed Introduction to the Enemy with her then-husband Tom Hayden and Haskell Wexler. She had been in North Vietnam. She had not only protested against the war, but had, you know, said sympathetic things about the North Vietnamese. And she's still to this day, I mean, people to the very far right end of the spectrum, if you mention Jane Fonda, somebody will snicker and say, Hanoi Jane, you know, like she's a traitor and this and that. So think about the phases she'd gone through. She'd been Barbarella, who was just like, you know, a sex object, if you will, just like a pinup on screen, the way Vadim packaged her there. She goes from that sort of airheaded presentation to, you know, a very serious role like Clute. And the seriousness also had political ramifications when she, you know, protested the war, made documentaries and other films that would reference it, and then, you know, very directly with Coming Home, do a film about it. But, you know, she is not Hanoi Jane in that film. In Coming Home, she's just a good American military wife who's really nervous about what will happen when her husband comes home, and she has reason to be worried about that. So, again, if I had to take it down just to one, for me, that registers as number one, one of her best performances. She gets another Academy Award. Number two, by way of zeitgeist, it really ties her into what's going on in the country.
Well, I'm going
to. How about
to,
you? What's your one?
My one, if you've never seen anything she's done, you've got to see 1980s 9 to 5, which I saw in the theater on a double date with my husband, who wasn't my husband yet. So I have, you know, fond memories of actually, you know, just going to the movies and seeing this movie. And it's absolutely hilarious. And it's got Lily Tomlin and Dolly Parton in it and Dabney Coleman. And at one point, when they've got Dabney Coleman trussed up, Jane Fonda's, you know, movie ex-husband comes in and sees it and says, I can't, what happened to you? what is this? Are you suddenly into S&M? And the best line ever, she says, we're divorced, and if I want to do M&Ms, you can't stop me. If only for that line, because it's awesome. And if you have Netflix, definitely try to check out Grace and Frankie, which is, Lily Tomlin and Jane Fonda working together again. So we're, kind of to wrap up, Mike, do you want to talk a little bit about On Golden Pond?
Yeah, let me first very quickly add to 9 to 5. I mean, she's arguing for women in the workplace. That came out in 1980. 1979, Jane Fonda was in Baltimore. She spoke at the then Baltimore Civic Center as part of a conference called In the 80s, Economic Fights of Working Women. So you see again how what she does on screen is reflected very directly what she's doing off screen. But yeah, to address your question, she finally did reconcile more or less with her father. In 1981, she received an Oscar nomination as an actress for On Golden Pond. She also produced that film specifically so that she could co-star in it with her father, Henry Fonda. And in many ways, it's a very public reconciliation. You get a sense of how the father and daughter had their struggles and all kinds of stress, but, and that gets played out within the film, but of course, it's also a reflection or a ramification of what their private lives are. And, I'm not the biggest fan of that as a film, but on a biographical level, it is quite moving to think about that contentious relationship between a father and daughter and how they really are able to reconcile within the film. And of course, Henry Fonda would win the Academy Award for that, and that's at the very end of his life. He was ill as they were shooting it. So it's quite moving on that level of film history and certainly personal biography.
Yeah, she has said when they were filming that there was a moment where she actually puts her hand on his arm, which was not scripted. It was just sort of a instinct. And she said, she actually saw him tearing up, which meant the world to her. I also remember when that movie was being filmed that she talked about how she practiced and practiced that flip off the dock because the movie also stars Katharine Hepburn, and she wanted to impress Katharine Hepburn. She wanted her to like her. So I think that's a nice anecdote to know about. It's always, I think it's kind of fun to know all those little small moments that go into big movies.
And she did immense preparation for a film like that. The casting of it, wanting to impress her father and Katharine Hepburn, both of whom are tough customers in their own way, right? And just, the care that she puts into things. So in terms of the rehearsal time, physically being in good shape, whether it's to, jump off a dock or whatever, but, she really is a complete professional as an actor. And I've always admired that in her, that she really does her homework, she knows the script, she really rehearses, she's there, She's not somebody who plays around. I mean, she really is very serious about her profession.
And sort of the nice denouement is her accepting the Academy Award for Henry Fonda for that movie later. That's a nice
Well, yeah,
little
those are always great moments in Oscar history when, it's an actor at the very end of his or her life, and in this case, yeah, sure, absolutely, where it's, Jane Fonda there for her dad, basically. I mean, they had not been there for each other for quite a few years, but yes, she was for him.
We should probably mention that Peter Fonda, as well, Jane's brother, had quite a illustrious career, especially with Easy Rider. Mike, what do you want to say about Peter Fonda?
Well, just as Jane Fonda had a very tangled, emotionally distant relationship with her father, Henry, Jane's brother, Peter, himself Hollywood royalty and certainly well known as an actor slash director, he had distance from his father as well. His most famous role, really, but both as, in terms of directing and acting, would be Easy Rider in 1969. And I would think of Henry Fonda as a Hollywood liberal in the sense of like straight down the middle, just right down the middle in terms of, voting the correct way and supporting the right causes and so on. But that Peter certainly was to the far left end of the political spectrum in that era. And that certainly added to whatever personal tension was there that, if you watch a film like Easy Rider, it's one of the all-time great zeitgeist movies, there's the word, in terms of where American society is or a portion of it in the late 60s. And there's Peter Fonda as, one of the motivating forces behind that film. But as you watch a film like that, you can't imagine that Henry would have watched it with much pleasure at that time. And so Peter really was very distant from his father for a long time. And Peter's had a kind of checkered career in various ways, but, working more at the independent film end than Jane. Jane's been mainstream Hollywood movies. But if you think of like Peter Fonda directing The Hired Hand and films like that, I mean, not a big audience, but a certain amount of critical recognition. And then late in his career, kind of bouncing back a bit with Yuli's Gold. And so, well-regarded, but sometimes would go for long stretches without too many screen credits, or they'd be relatively small independent films. So he is working as an actor, but he's never quite the huge star that Jane Fonda is in that period. But anyway, to get to the heart of your question, although both Jane and Peter were estranged from their father, there was a reconciliation of sorts for all of them, but really coming at the very end of Henry's life.
I also want to mention that Peter Fonda's daughter, Bridget Fonda, has actually made a name for herself too, in Single White Female and Jackie Brown and Kiss of the Dragon and all those movies. So it really is a family of actors.
It really is. You almost have to go back to like the Barrymore family or something, where he's like multi-generational, like a famous actor, and then the children, and then grandchildren, whatever. It really is. You can think of other examples as well, but it's quite notable that this really is a dynasty in some ways, and everybody's done well. I mean, they've all had their their ups and their downs, but they've all really had lasting careers, and it's really quite striking the extent to which these and their distinctive talents. You know what I mean? Like when you think about them as actors, they're actually all very different as actors.
Well, that brings us to the end of our segment. Don't forget to check us out on dragondigitalradio.podbean.com and to look up some Jane Fonda movies if you're stuck at home in the quarantine. And we will see you at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.